Chapter 6, Preparing Your Material for Publication, by Jamie Buckingham.
The girl who opens the mail spilled coffee on your manuscript, and now it's illegible. We told you not to send that 700-page manuscript to our fax machine, and you did anyway. Three people got fired today, and I've decided to reject all manuscripts which arrive on Friday for the next 6 months. Well, I have a feeling that some of the reasons are you've got to fall into those categories for rejection. And you need to understand that when you submit manuscripts, whether it's a book or a magazine article, whatever it is that you want to get published, that you are dealing with a real live person on the other end who indeed may have a headache or a tummy ache or just gone through a divorce or something else, and he's in a very foul mood when your inspirational piece crosses his desk, and there's a possibility that he just may fire it back to you just on the basis of that kind of thing. Those things do happen. So what I want to do is to encourage you is when it just comes back to you with no correctable reasons given to resubmit it. We were talking about Frank Peretti's This Present Darkness last night, and you said it had been submitted to a number of different...
Well, the number grows as the story...
Yeah, I know. Those things become legendary, and they're kind of like mold on the cheese, you know. It gets bigger.
It is really true that Agnes Vanceford, The Healing Light, was submitted to every major publisher, and nobody picked it up until McAllister Park, which is a minor publisher.
Yeah, one of the legendary stories of that kind of thing is about 35 years ago, 30 years ago, 35 I guess now, there was a little Church of God layman who had a idea for a comic strip that he thought the people would like to read, and he was a part-time artist, and so he started submitting this thing around to various syndicates and newspapers, and everybody turned him down. I mean, nobody was interested in a little round-headed boy who called himself Charlie Brown, and it went to something like 30 or 35 syndicates before somebody said, well, we'll give a shot at this thing. And, of course, Peanuts has been at the top of the list just overnight and ever since. So you really don't know. You need to be persistent in this game and keep it up. I remember talking with a guy a couple of years ago who had submitted something to Newsweek magazine, of all things. Now, Newsweek is nearly all in-house written. Their own editors do the work on Newsweek. But they have a page which they call their, in ministries today we call it our soapbox page, but it's
My Turn,
yeah. Which is written by different people. Now, oftentimes these things are written by editors who've picked this up, or they're written in-house, but occasionally a freelancer will get in on this. And this guy was up in Raleigh, North Carolina, and he had submitted this to Newsweek, and they had fired it right back at him. I mean, obviously they haven't even read it at all. And just with one of these curt rejection notices on this doesn't meet our needs at the present time kind of thing. And he waited 6 months and sent it back to them, and they accepted it. This time he didn't change a word. This time it just went over the desk of another editor somehow, or maybe over the same editor or whatever. But they accepted it and ran it. So you need to be persistent in your submissions with what you're doing. And you also, if you do find an editor who has enough time to look at your material and say, this has promise, but then you really need to pursue that. Any little glimmer of hope, then you need to pursue it. And get to work correcting it. Now that could, usually when you get a letter like that or a note back that says this has promise, but what that translates to mean is that there is a huge amount of work coming at you in the future, because that's going to mean rewriting and perhaps a lot more research and many other things that are going to need to be done. But in the long run, you'll get published. But deadlines are set with purpose. And the concept of a deadline, especially on a book, now it's true with magazine article also, but magazine articles, the deadlines happen so rapidly they kind of pass you by. But with a book, there is a huge amount of material that has already been scheduled with editors and with typesetters and with proofreaders and with the printers and with the binders, and all of these people have calendars, and they've all marked on their calendars that your manuscript will be arriving across their desk on this particular date, and so they push other things aside and they have it all blocked off. It's like going to the dentist office. He has you're scheduled 6 months ahead, but if you don't show up on that date, then he loses your $75 or whatever it is, because he can't call up somebody and say, come into my office right now. She didn't show up for the dentist appointment. So they lose that. And this is what happens with the deadlines, that there's reasons behind these things. Now, granted, oftentimes these things will get pushed around and moved around, but there are a large number of schedules that depend on you getting your material in on time, because of all these other things. I joke about it sometimes, that if I don't get it there's people going to come after me because I have lost them money or caused all kinds of problems, and that's real. Let me talk for just a minute on what happens to your manuscript. Let's just take this thing from the very beginning and kind of follow it through. I think this will be beneficial to you. Whether it's done on a word processor, whether it's done on a typewriter, is really incidental to the editor, as long as the ribbon's good. That is important. It's also important that you double space. A single space manuscript, you can't edit. And so even in the first draft, you should start with if it's a book manuscript, now you can get by with a magazine sometimes, article. But with a book manuscript, it ought to be double spaced. Don't send him accordion sheets of paper. Tear them apart. If you're using a tractor feed, so that each page is an individual page, they're not all attached together. So that when your manuscript comes in, it's on separate individual pages. And
you prefer ragged edges, don't you? Instead of a
yeah. It really doesn't make that much difference, I guess, does it, Walter? Yeah. You see, you're not setting up a book format at this time. You're just sending the material that they want to look at and perhaps edit at the same time.
Ben, and we can spot those, but it's not that big.
Yeah. Let me say a couple of things right here that are so elementary that people miss them. One of them is never send your only copy. I can tell you horror story after horror story of only copies that have disappeared, or that great hunks of them have disappeared. It's not unusual for an editor to drop your manuscript on the floor, and when he picks it up, there's pages missing. They've gotten where pages go when you drop them on the floor. But so don't send your only copy.
Or the secretary spills coffee on them if you open it.
Exactly, and that happens also. The second thing is, please make sure that your name and address is not only on the cover letter and not only on the envelope that's sent in, but is on the first page of the manuscript. Now, you don't need to put it on every page of the manuscript. But I got a manuscript, an excellent manuscript, that a that a medical doctor sent me from Greenville, South Carolina, back after I was healed on nutrition. And he has done massive work in the area of nutrition. And he thought that I would be interested in it. Well, I was interested in it, in what he had to say. And I thought it might make it was short, but I thought if he enlarged on it, it could be a good book. And he never gave me his name. It was not on the envelope. It was not on the manuscript. All I knew that he was a medical doctor from Greenville, South Carolina, and that his father had been an undertaker. Because that was in the... And I guess I could have traced that back with the help of a private detective and could have called all the medical doctors in Greenville and found out whose father had been an undertaker. But
write in your next column as the PS with the doctor.
I know.
Wait, and we'll get an irate letter from this doctor in South Carolina demanding why we didn't respond.
That's right. That's what will happen. People get really angry with you, and then... And the problem is, I think I finally dumped the manuscript. I mean, I kept
that was
it.
His only copy, James.
I pulled out several pages that would benefit me, but I can't afford just my house is tilting right now under the weight of paper and manuscripts to keep that stuff in there. So after a while, you throw it away. My garbage man hates to see me because my trash barrel is filled with paper. So make sure you have your name and address, and make sure it's not your only copy. I was talking with Mark last night, and he's working on his on his manuscript on this. We'll allow him in the early stages of the game to format this. You remember we were struggling with how these things should appear on paper in order to communicate to this digital age in which we now live, where we don't have just long running paragraphs that all kind of bleed together like Francis Frangipane's first book did. I mean, you open that thing up, and if you're not really interested in that, you're not gonna read it now, because the content was so good. But there was no breakings, no sub paragraph breakings. There was no bold print. There was nothing to break the eye as you look at the page. And so we're talking about how to do this and how to use quote outs and put them in the book and how to use subheads and how to space and how to write short paragraphs. And Mark was talking about a rather innovative concept of using the anecdotal material. We were talking about the scenes, you remember, but using the didactic in a different color type. If he could do that, he was playing off of my early use of the red and black ribbon in my typewriter, where all of my illustrations were in red and all of my didactic was in black. When I was writing my sermons out in those early days, would this be possible in the book to do that? Well, no, it's really not possible because it causes a second print run. You can't print a book in red and black. That just runs the prices way out.
No, it is possible.
Well, it's possible, yeah, but you have to run it through the second time is what it takes. It takes a second print run to do in two colors.
Or on a two-color press.
Which is a possibility. I mean, you can have, he asked me if I knew of any books that were done that way, and I said the only one I knew was the Bible, with the red letter editions of the Bible. But there are other ways to do it, which may be just as good. How to break these, how to put a five-space paragraph, how to indent, and drop it over if you have, like the case studies are done in psychological and sociological books sometimes, where you have a case study and it's indented. In fact, it's a kind of intriguing way to read, because everybody, their eye immediately goes to it.
Betty?
I find it mandatory when I write to visualize, is that still a good term? To visualize what my book is going to look like on paper. Now, I don't see that on the screen in front of me as I'm sitting there writing, because I got 80 characters across the screen and that's it. I may break it a little bit with spaces, but I like to visualize what that's going to look like on paper. Just like I like to visualize the jacket cover, what that's going to look like. I have that even before we get started. They may never use. In fact, I may never say anything to them about how I think the jacket ought to be designed. One of the things I've learned with growing older is there are certain things you just you keep your mouth shut about, and that's the things you don't know anything about. And marketing is one of those things for me. I still open my mouth sometimes, but I like to have that. Just like I need to have the title in my mind. I have a working title because we talked yesterday about themes, and so oftentimes the working title will be tied in with the theme, although it may not be the title that goes on the book itself, because titles are marketing issues. They are not a synopsis of the book. And titles are only for the purpose of marketing. Yeah, but what we want to do is to encourage you to think this way, because often, see, most of you are not thinking as writers as much as you're thinking as readers, and that's fine, because as you think as readers, you will give us those who are working in the editing and the publishing end of it. I'm not doing that, but you will give them. Ideas that they would not come up with anyway, because they're caught in a framework of tradition is awfully hard to break. It's not just hard to break in religion, it's awfully hard to break in publishing and in editing at the same time. And so you're caught in that kind of framework. So keep the innovative ideas coming. Now, Debbie mentioned to me last night, and I want to reiterate this. One of the major problems, we have it with magazines all the time, but it's with books as well, is that you will give us, and by us I mean the editorial office, when you send your material in, whether it's a magazine article or a book, all this wonderful information and choice bits of information you have and research that you've done, and you will translate that, you'll digest that, you'll put it on paper, but then you don't give us sources on this. And as a result, the publishing company suddenly gets a red flag that goes up. I mean, here you have quoted somebody, and it may be a controversial quote, but you don't give us the source of that quote. You have not footnoted it, or you have not had an appendum that goes with it somehow to say where that comes from. And as a result, this puts the publishing company in a liable position and puts you in a liable position. Or it may be just in an offensive position because you will have offended somebody. And it may be that your quote is wrong. It may be that you've gotten bad material from someplace. And so part of what you're doing in your writing is doing research. And if you don't do it, the publisher or the editor will have to do it for you, and this will delay everything that's happening. And it's really up to you to get this done. So for the sake of the editor and for the sake of the publisher, you need to say where that came from. Now, if it's a research book, it really may go with your book, for instance, Bill, which is something of a historical book. It ought to be annotated, it ought to be footnoted.
Yes.
So that your reader can go back and double check. He may not want to double check as much as he want more information on what you're saying. For the normal teaching book, or for the novel that comes in, or for anything else, we'll not run footnotes with the material, or not even run a page at the end or 10 pages at the end with all of your references. But the editor needs to know this,
so we can double-check it for accuracy.
There's no copyright on ideas. You can't copyright an idea, but if you're going to quote...
Wonderful
things
surfacing your memory, the inspiration.
Yeah, and that's wonderful. I mean, there's no new thing under the sun, Solomon said. See, everything, you don't come up with anything original. Nobody comes up with anything. It's just a rearranging of stuff that we already knew into a way that makes it sound different, that's all, and helps with the communication.
To get the permission ourselves, or whether you guys do it, or
yeah,
we get it.
Yeah.
Okay.
You get it, because you're the one who's going to be the primary one who's going to get sued.
Yeah.
so it's up to you. And you know, there's all these horror stories out there of people who have been sued off the misuse of material, or just liable if you're not careful. And that happens, of course, it happens in your preaching as well as it happens in your writing. That thing that happened to Larry Tomczak several years ago is a nightmare that everybody faces. Larry fielded a story that he had heard Bob Mumford tell about, what's his name, Harris, William Harris, having committed suicide.
Thomas
Harris, author of I'm Okay, You're Okay, having committed suicide. And Larry made a kind of a play on it. And then he wakes up one morning with the Washington Post saying there's a $16 million lawsuit filed against him. And it was a nightmare for him. Cost him $250,000 in legal fees. And then they sued Bob Mumford. And then they sued the tape company that had recorded the message. And then they sued the radio station that had played the tape. And I mean, it was horrible the time they finished. They settled it the morning before it was to go into court 2 years later. But everybody lost hundreds of thousands of dollars in that thing, and the tape ministry wound up going out of business. The poor guy lost everything.
Is quoting a newspaper article different than quoting a book? In other words, is that public domain or not?
It depends on whether the newspaper article is copyrighted. Sometimes there will be a copyright on a particular article, which is to keep it from being copied. Mostly newspapers are public domain, but you still need to give credit, as you do with a magazine. U.S. News and World Report in September 1990 said, and then you're okay on that. Now, if you quote more than 75 lines, you need to go back to U.S. News and get their permission. 75 words, you need to go back and get their permission to do that. And the same thing is true with the newspaper. But don't just say, newspapers all over the world reported that. For the sake of what we were talking about the other day, use a concrete word because it means more to the reader. St. Louis Post-Dispatch or the San Francisco Chronicle or whatever it was said in reporting on. But then even if you use the newspaper as your primary source of information, you are liable if you have quoted misinformation. So if the New Orleans Times-Picayune said that the mayor of New Orleans is a homosexual, and you quote from that, saying that the mayor of New Orleans is a homosexual, and he's not, then they're going to come after you as much as they're going to come after the newspaper. In fact, they may not go after the newspaper. They may go after you, because it's hard to sue a newspaper. But they can sure get hold of you. So you just need to make sure that your facts are accurate in that. And the way to do it is just to do research, just to call around a little bit and run things by people with that. But the big thing that they're interested in is that you'll jot these things down. Now, I, with magazine stuff, if we get information on various things that are happening, I always keep that until after the magazine has gone into, after that story has been published. Then I'll throw it away. But I have learned, because I'm constantly getting calls from whoever's editing my column or the magazine stuff that we have from Ministries Today, somebody calling back over to where I am and say, where did you get your information on this? And sometimes the question's real embarrassing because I can't remember. And, well, I think I heard it at a conference someplace. So that won't do. You better find out, because everybody's going to wind up in court on this if you're not careful. And as Paul Harvey has said, we have become a nation of sewers. And
more ways than one. Let me tell a story about an article in Charisma. A man who most of you know told a wonderful story. That he told it in a sermon at our church. He was talking about evangelism. He talked about how he went by it. Cursed this tavern and so forth, and the guy repented and got saved and shut down the tavern and all this stuff, and it's a great anecdote. And so we turned it into an article, and we said, okay, tell us the name of the tavern in the city, the guy's name, because the guy's supposed to become a youth pastor or something, you know. And it turned out, they didn't know where this was, you know. And, well, he'd moved it or something, and then they found out that he had heard the story from somebody and couldn't remember who told him the story. And actually, you know, I'm giving the guy the benefit of the doubt, he probably did hear something, but he told the story so many times, it had improved on each retelling. And so, of course, we didn't run it. I mean, and it wasn't really the kind of thing you get sued over. It was just over the interest of accuracy. And he told me later that he repented over that thing. We weren't really even confronting him as if he'd done anything wrong. We were just sort of doing our job. In fact, we were a little bit embarrassed on his behalf, you know. Like, after we found this out, we didn't even really rub it in. But he told me he'd never do that again. And he shouldn't. They say evangelistically speaking for a reason.
Evangelistically speaking.
Now, a number of years ago, there was one of these floating stories that was going around about people picking up hitchhikers on the road, and the hitchhiker would say, Jesus is coming again, repent, get ready, and then would disappear out of the car. And so I decided to trace this thing down. I was working at Logos Journal at the time, and so everybody who told that story, I went to them and I asked them specifically, and I got all these embarrassed kind of answers. Well, I heard it from so-and-so. Well, tell me so-and-so's name. I'm going to call him on the phone. And so I traced it back, and it had never happened. It was just something that people were talking about. Now, more recently, there's another one that's going around about preacher sitting on the airplane besides the guy who is praying over his meal, and he turns to him and he says, I see you're praying over me. And the guy says, yes, I'm a Satanist, and I'm praying that all Christian homes will be destroyed. Well, I've started tracing that one down, and I have never talked to anybody.
Jim LaHaye.
Actually had that experience.
Jim LaHaye says he did.
I will call Tim LaHaye and find out. Because see, we printed it in Ministries Today. Jack Taylor told the story in Ministries Today, and then one of our readers pinned Jack to the wall on this with a letter to the editor, and said, "I've heard that story from 19 different people. Did it start with you?" And Jack kind of backpedaled real past and got over here in his Baptist corral someplace.
Jimmy, in Tim LaHaye's book on the 17 fallen leaders, the restoration of them. He's got that story in there, and I'm sure he said that he was...
Well, that makes it true. If Tim put it in print, it has to be true.
Well, the problem when it gets in print, people start quoting Ministries Today.
That's right, or they quote Tim LaHaye's book.
One of the things that I appreciated with last year, we came back from Kenya when the Antichrist cult stood up when we were in Nairobi and went to shoot us, and the government intervened and all these things happened, was the fact that you did research it. And the fact that that cult shutting down during our crusade has had a national impact in Kenya.
It's researched.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And when you researched it, it helped some of our missionaries that had been going in there to add finality to the shutting down of that cult. And some of the other areas in Mombasa and different things have taken your article that you wrote, the newspaper articles, where there's some of these other splinter groups of the blood sacrifice cult groups out there, met with their leaders, and literally, because I just came back from Kenya 3 weeks ago, and literally used that information to help shut those other cult groups down, telling them that it's already overthrown. So validating stories is absolutely critical.
Let me tell you a little bit about what you need to do. We've talked about how to build your manuscript when you're sending it in, but there are still basic reasons that books are rejected when they come in, and preachiness is one of them. Somehow you have got to learn to put into effect what we gave you early. So that your book will not sound preachy. People do not want to read material that is finger pointing. You've got to come obliquely to the reader to make it right. You cannot preach on paper. It just won't fly. That's all. You've got to use other skills. You've got to take this as a challenge as to how to get an ethical message across or how to get another kind of message across without coming directly at him with your finger out. You can't do that. You can't be dogmatic as you do this. You've got to leave... The one thing that most writers don't understand is that their readers are more intelligent than they are. And therefore, if you will understand that, you will not insult the intelligence of the reader by telling him everything you know, because he will then know that you have told him everything you know, and that will prove that he knows more than you do. So you leave a lot of these things open-ended, so the reader has the openness of the Holy Spirit to come into his life and to give you additional information on what's happening. I've always felt it was a compliment to me when I saw people sitting under my preaching and getting one of those faraway looks in their eyes. They're not listening to me anymore, they're listening to God. Something I have said to them has sparked something, and suddenly they're, oh yeah, oh yeah, oh yeah, oh yeah. And everything else I say is incidental to the fact that now God is speaking to them about something. Your writing should do that to people, so that as they read what you have written, suddenly the words may blur in front of them as tears come in their eyes.
The story about the sermon that you illustrated, and everyone remembered it, and nobody remembers any of your other sermons. Because that's a good example of...
Yeah, I don't know which one you're talking about, but there's... Well, there's hundreds of those kinds of things. Yeah, I've done a lot of that kind of crazy stuff. Yeah, it was the warts that I got later on.
What spiritual truth is that?
Well, it's the whole thing. This is what. But I remember several years ago, I'd lost a considerable amount of weight, 65 pounds, and had lost it over a 3-month period of time. And the Lord said, you can't say anything about it until you've kept it off 6 months, because otherwise you're going to be like Francis Hunter. You're going to write a book on how to lose fat, and then you're trying to sell it after you've put it all back on again, you know. And that's kind of embarrassing. Tammy Faye Baker, Oprah Winfrey, all these people who have lost huge amounts of weight and then have popped right back on again. So God said, you can't say anything about it until you've kept it off for a while. So I waited until my set point on my weight adjusted down to from 230 to 170, and kind of set in right there, and I realized that I was okay, and I had by that time got out and bought a whole new wardrobe and thrown my old wardrobe away, and then one day I came in on a Sunday morning. a friend had gone down to the butcher shop for me and had gotten a huge plastic bag of fat with 65 pounds of fat in it. And I brought that into the service that Sunday morning in this huge, big bag. Barely pick it up. And I preached on, let us lay aside every weight that is so easily beset us and run with patience the race that is set before us. And it's amazing how many people you make angry when you do that. All the pudgy people in the current, some of the pregnant women thought I was picking on them, and but they remembered the illustration. The picture was worth all of my thousands of words. Nobody remembered what I preached about. All I could remember was that big bag of fat sitting up there on the platform. This is what I'd been carrying around all these years. If you can illustrate your material, what Steve was talking about with Judson, of most of you preach in pictures, at least I hope you do. I hope you have learned to use the illustrative material in your public presentation, so that you will do an ample amount of storytelling. You will illustrate your points either with events out of your own life or events out of the lives of other people, because your reader or your listener is visually oriented. He needs some kind of visualization to grasp what you're talking about. So to be able to use the anecdote correctly. Now, there's nothing more difficult to do than what Reader's Digest calls the elongated anecdote, which is where you take one story and turn your whole book into that, based on that one story. It's like the present-day sitcoms, situation comedies, are all based on one joke. That's all. If you ever talk to a writer or one of these things, you find out that all they do is they'll take one joke or one concept, and that half hour is all based on that one thing. Everything relates to that one little thing. And that's difficult to do in a book. You can't stretch that thing out. So you need many anecdotes, many stories, many illustrations to illustrate what you're doing. And if your book comes in and it's all didactic, your editor is going to send it back to you. He's going to fire that thing back and say, you've got to put some windows in this house. All we've got is a warehouse. And we've got to get some, the illustrations are really the windows that let the light onto the manuscript itself. So just keep that in mind. Build those in all the time. Oftentimes you're transcribing your sermon onto paper. Which is fine. I mean, a lot of my earlier books, all the semi-autobiographical books, Risky Living and Where Eagles Soar, and even Coping with Criticism, I guess, were taken from sermons. They began with messages that I had preached to my church, and I had somebody in the church, a secretary, an editor, to type those things off onto paper, and then I collected them and I began to sort them through, and I realized there were some that would kind of fit together, and then I went through and rewrote those, edited those, so they did not sound sermonic, but they became the basis of what the book was like. It is a different kind of communication. Of course, I preach as a storyteller. I'm not an expository preacher. I can do expository preaching. I just don't do very much of it. My sermonic style is more situational preaching, as we mentioned earlier, the Harry Emerson Fosdick approach, than it is the 3 points in a poem approach. So it was easier for me to do. But you can still do that. Now, I remember working on a Bob Mumford series of sermons. Bob wanted me to take his stuff and see if I could do something with it, and I couldn't do anything with it. Because when Bob preaches, he's one of the finest communicators in the nation when he's standing up to preach. But when you try to translate what he has said onto paper, you can't do it, because he relies so much on facial expression and on hand gesture, and he does a lot of repeating. He'll say it over and over and over and over again, 4, 5, 6 times, or he'll come at it from a different... And by the time you've edited it all down, you've just got a tiny little handful of stuff to go on paper, because you can't put all of that, did you hear what I said? Now, let me say it again to you. You can't put all that on paper. Where...
It's funny, though. Of the books that he's done, he's got some of the finest. 16 Steps Out, which was real back 20 years ago.
Yeah, that was the first one, and I worked on that.
That was powerful.
Yeah, but it took a lot of work. Now, the recent stuff that Bob is doing, by the way, even his recent messages, he's outlining everything. In fact, the conferences I have been with him in recently, he's even passing out outlines to the congregation, to the folks who are there at the conference, outlining, because he has already so thoroughly prepared what he's going to say. Now, he'll often digress from that, as there's some kind of special anointing that falls on him for it. But he's doing massive work, which I think is a very wise thing to do for a guy who does not have a church to fall back on in his ministry. That he is outlining his material so he can get double use out of it. He will not only preach it, but it will go into book form as well. And then he's using some of the same material in his newsletter. It's very similar to what Chuck Swindoll's doing, although Chuck also uses it in his radio program. But it all comes from one source, and it's done that way. Benny, I don't know how much of your Good Morning Holy Spirit came out of your preaching. How much of that had you preached ahead of time?
I'd say probably 90%.
Yeah, okay. So you got double use out of it. I mean, it started with your... I'm sure it started with the preaching. It didn't start with the book itself, did it?
I'm sorry?
I say it started with the... It started from the pulpit. It didn't start from the... As you put it on paper.
That's right.
Yeah. And... It's just a normal way for people who are in the communication business, who are either preaching or who are teaching. Judson, I'm sure that much of yours comes that way, doesn't it?
Well over half. And then sometimes I reverse that. I write the book, turn around, go back, hey, that's not too bad, so I'll outline it and preach it.
Yeah. Not ashamed of it after all that. Okay. All of these things are, things like the mechanical things can be corrected in your manuscript. Poor grammar, poor spelling, those things can be corrected. You need to have the ability, we talked about the figures of speech, you need to know what a metaphor and a simile are so that you won't cross those things up. And with more practice, you will begin to use the intriguing little areas, like personification, which give just enough brightness to the thing. You don't need to do those all the way through, but every once in a while you need to drop over and really work on a line until it sings. Now, every line doesn't need to sing, but you need to work on some of those lines until they are almost poetic, putting those words together until you have them just right, so there's enough of that your reader will go from note to note. He'll skip over a lot of bad stuff and those things will keep him bright. That's what stories do. That's what anecdotes do.
This concludes Chapter 6, Preparing Your Material for Publication, by Jamie Buckingham.